This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The title, The Kids Want Communism, actually is a sticker I found in Zurich, in Switzerland, on a bus stop. And after a little bit of research, this was 2012, I learned that the youth movement of the Socialist Party, which is like this, it's local, but it's part of a network throughout the German-speaking countries. They use this slogan, the kids want communism. So I approached them, I was working in a museum, and I'll tell you all about the project I was doing, and they said, yeah, why not, use that. So we changed the design and so on, and this is designed by Avi Buchbut, this kind of logo. And I want to kind of read that title. The meaning of communism here combines two traditions of thought. On the one hand, it readdresses real existing socialism. And with real existing socialism, I would say also its peripheries. And by that, I also mean the welfare state, which is kind of an effect of the reality of socialism in other countries. So Western Europe being like this place where there was still some struggle going on between socialism and capitalism had to kind of at least give something to labored, to the working classes. And so real existing socialism with its achievements and crimes, and on the other hand, communism as a horizon that provides actually a perspective outside the current setting of power for us to understand the world. And this is basically Jody Dean's idea of the communist horizon. I'll come back to it in a little bit. So this is what communism stands for. From this perspective, we can see what was, what is, and what will be. The want in the title denotes the kind of the imagination and the role of desire. And here I quote directly Jody Dean when she says, she calls communism the collective desire for collectivity. And so with the kids stand, the way I see it, for both the future and the present, being that they are already here, but they are the ones that will also be here tomorrow. So that is very true also to the project of communism, you know, beyond this socialist utopism and so on, that it starts now. Now we act, and so on. Okay. So now I'll do it a little bit more dramatic, the opening. Spectres are haunting the globe, the spectres of anti-communism. From the European Union and its erosion to the disastrous war on terror, to the destruction of the welfare state, from Wahhabism to neoliberalism, debt economy, privatization, game theory, disruptive innovation, real existing internet, all those things are different forms of anti-communism that are now fighting each other. And so they're haunting us. And what started 30 years ago, kind of to the day, right, November 89, with the collapse of the socialist republics in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and the arrangements that came out of that moment 30 years ago, we can see how this echoes today where we stand, where those arrangements, you know, the neoliberal Washington consensus and so on, is collapsing around us. And, you know, some of the kind of timelines can go back to Hobbes, you know, with like systems that were built long ago that are now kind of seem not to work anymore. And today, like now it's evening in Philadelphia, but in Haiti, Ecuador, Chile, Lebanon, Catalonia, Egypt, and the UK, there are constant daily uprisings against the late neoliberal and late fascist policies of the governments there, and they're only gaining momentum. The thing is that usually what we get to see actually is, especially here in US media, is the situation in the corporate colony of Hong Kong demanding less Chinese control, and sometimes under the flag of Union Jack, and this is the slogan, "Make Hong Kong Great Britain Again." So you see how the imagination is so limited for us while stuff is happening. Okay. In his last essay from 2009, published after his passing, the French communist Daniel Ben Said wrote, "Of all the words that once drove forward great dreams and tremendous promise, communism has suffered the greatest damage because of the way it was captured by bureaucratic realpolitik and made subservient to a totalitarian enterprise. The question remains, however, as to whether among all these damaged words, there are those worth repairing and setting back in motion." And here, this is a piece by Davidas Breve, who's an artist from Lithuania, where he made these mock, like, fake posters for this, you know, potential film with Leonardo DiCaprio as Lenin and Spielberg. This is like, he posted it 2 weeks ago. So at least in his mind and mine, something's going on. The book Being Together Precedes Being is a textbook for this project, The Kids Want Communism, which we are celebrating today. And it follows this project, The Kids Want Communism, which was a 2.5 years long platform of exhibitions, screenings, publications, discussions, and even a summer school. And all this took place in Kiev, in Tel Aviv, Athens, Warsaw, Ljubljana, Prague, Melbourne, Australia, and Berlin. Organized around the 99th anniversary for the Bolshevik Revolution, the project explored not only what happened, but also what could have happened, what might have happened, and what might still happen. And so, you know, we were working on this before the 100 years exhibition, like the centennial, but you could already know that MoMA would do 100 years to the Russian Revolution. No one is here today because there was a revolution in Russia. I mean, there was a revolution in Russia, but it was a communist revolution. And that also meant, and you know, the USSR doesn't stand for, there's no Russia in USSR. It's the United Socialist Soviet Republics. And so anywhere can be Soviet Union. And the person who knew that best was Woodrow Wilson in this country. And that's how Bolshevik became a term for a foreign agent. So they were able to territorialize something that was actually planetary and informed, as you'll see from the project that I'll show you, very different communisms from very different places around the world. So the project The Kids Want Communism was organized basically either through archives of real existing socialisms or more like the proposal of what could communism be for us today. And the book is organized according to six themes: the communist horizon, real existing capitalism, shock work, post-Soviet depression, Red Star, and the International. And now I'm going to show you a video. That's the trailer for the show. So it started with Honecker and Brezhnev, of course, and then, you know, it's people thought then that things are not going so well when it's a very steep slope of kisses. So at the museum, I hope you can see that, right? At the museum where I worked, we organized this exhibition that actually ran for 2.5 years, while other six institutions around the world, as I mentioned, we're also doing different projects, and I'll show you a little bit of that. So the Red Star was a big part of this kind of understanding that another world is possible, and as you know, Mars, in our imagination today, basically plays the role of another territory to colonize, in that we will create an atmosphere there only to ruin it with capitalism again. That's like the big plan of, you know, these entrepreneurs. Well, the Red Star had other things, like played a different role in the imagination, of course, Soviet sci-fi, Alexander Bogdanov, the Red Star as a place, Aelita, if you know the movie, a place where actually, you know, another world that's possible, communism. And so this is a work that, well, there's the title, so you can just see the title, so I won't go into detail. Another work is actually a machine for group daydreaming. Can you see the bunk beds? Yeah? Structure for rest. Can you see the writing on the back? Yeah? It's by Ohad Meromi, an artist. The previous one was Noa Yaffe, female artist. And as part of this exhibition, we also invited a group of artists called New Barbizon. It's five painters, female painters, all who grew up in the Soviet Union, and we invited them to show work that they did as kids in the Soviet Union, and then work from today about their childhood. So these are, for example, two prints by Olga Kundina. This is Zoya Cherkasky. You see the map of the Soviet Union? You have Kiev and Moscow in the same map. This is when she was 9. She did this drawing, quite remarkable. Asya Lukin, drawings from the 1980s. Natalia Zurobova, this is like a describing the ski day in the Soviet Union. And so this is like a piece from today. As part of the project, we also had exhibition Notes on Division, curated by Ilyana Fokianaki, which brought back the situation around the financial crisis in Greece actually not only brought back the military dictatorship, but also the history of the civil war in Greece, 46-49, and basically the reemergence of fascism, blatant fascism in Greece in our time. And then Praxis School was a project curated by Vladimir Vidmar, who's a curator based in Ljubljana. And Praxis School is a kind of the missing link between the Frankfurt School and the Ljubljana School. If you know Mladen Dolar, Alenka Zupančič, Slavoj Žižek, Renata Slačel, and others. And so this was a philosophical school in Yugoslavia that had this summer school that Western and Eastern Marxists would meet. So you would have, for example, Ernst Bloch coming, and on the other hand, you would have Marcuse coming, right? And we used their archives kind of to tell the story of Praxis School. Another project was curated by Teresa Steskalova, who's a curator from Prague. It's called Filmmakers of the World Unite, and it's focusing on students from around the world that came to study in Prague in the 50s and 60s, and the idea was that this was actually the instigator for those demands that then culminated in what's called the Spring of Prague, that then also brought the Soviet Union, you know, with tanks to Prague to crush that uprising. But it's basically being inside as part of the Soviet bloc is what made this kind of cultural revival, because you would have, for example, in FAMU, the film school in Prague, students from Sri Lanka, India, Iran, Syria, and we digitized those films for this project for the first time, basically, since they were made in the 60s and 50s. And basically, they were also never shown in their home countries because of, you know, there was one print and it was in the school library. So even when the filmmakers went home, they couldn't get a copy with them. As part of it, we had a whole archive. And for example, here you can see a demonstration in Prague, in the old city, 1961, after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected president of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I mean, you can see that you have students from Africa. And so the project around the world included, for example, in Kiev, as part of the School of Kiev, together with the Visual Culture Research Center, this conference, The Postman Always Rings Twice, Why History Repeats Itself. It was especially because of the tumbling down of the statues of Lenin that we saw in 2015, but already happened in the 90s. Why do you have to do it again? And those repetitions, US invaded Iraq 1991. Why do you have to do it again in 2003? I come from Israel. You flatten, you know, the biggest refugee camp at the time, this is before Syria, time and time again. Why do you do it again and again in Gaza? So it was around those kind of, you know, this kind of repeat and the inability to get out of where we were standing. In Poland, we had a summer camp run by the Free Slow University of Warsaw. Transit Prague hosted the first Congress of the Union of Soviet Artists. This is mainly, yeah, artists from the Soviet Union living outside of the Soviet Union. And in Skuch Gallery in Ljubljana, there was an exhibition by Ukrainian artist Nikita Kadan focusing on the pedestals and the bases of those toppled statues and monuments of the Soviet Union in Ukraine. In Athens, Space of Concept hosted a symposium which eventually resulted in a book called Communists Anonymous. In Melbourne, West Space held a screening of films from different projects, Soviet sci-fi, student films from the Soviet bloc. And in Berlin, at the end, like the centennial, we had in this place, Kunstraum Kreuzberg-Bethanien, an exhibition with like a selection of the different projects. Two projects that I want to show just to inform where we stand today. One is this, Nicole Vermeer's. It's called The Great Soviet Encyclopedia from 2016. Can you see it? It's basically an edition of The Great Soviet Encyclopedia in this kind of incubator, or maybe like a buffet kind of, or maybe sarcophagus. In any case, The Great Soviet Encyclopedia here stands for the knowledge that disappeared in the black hole of 89-91. The Great Soviet Encyclopedia is used here to denote the whole universe that seems to have no reference anymore. Systems of meaning and life experience, schools of thought and forms of existence, imaginations and circumstances, and the endless combinations between all of them. So Soviet knowledge basically is put on display because, and this is something I truly believe, it can help us understand actually where we stand today. There used to be a science, Sovietology, so like we should bring it back somehow, but not only like Kremlinology, like, you know, the knowledge of what's going on in the corridors of power of the Politburo and all that, but like what was going on the different levels of experience and what we can learn from that. Year one, this was a project I was very much invested in. It's called Year One, Jewish Arab Brotherhood. It's photos from the archives of the Communist Party in Israel, which were actually never researched, so it was the first time it happened when we did it. And we focused specifically on the story of a group of 20 Jewish and Arab communists from Palestine who went to Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia and their journey in 1947, so a year before the 48 war. And their journey informs this idea, first of all, that it simulates a parallel reality for a Jewish-Arab commonwealth and cooperation in Palestine, but also the places they chose to go also kind of create a map of internationalism, and I'll explain in a second. We had interviews with people who actually took part in this. This is Oda El Ashab. He's in his 90s. He worked in the printing of the Communist Party daily newspaper in Israel all his life. And you can see here Oda El Ashab on the right next to the guy with the banner, that's David Rabinovich, Oda El Ashab, who we also interviewed. Oda El Ashab, they went to Yugoslavia as an expedition of 20 men and women to help build the Samac-Sarajevo Railroad by invitation from Marshal Tito to build Yugoslavia as one state. And and they were just one of many groups that were there. Here you have Oda El Ashab, like the pen can show you that he's behind there. They just won a medal because they were very productive with laying the tracks. And then here, this is probably the highlight of the political life of some of those people. Oda El Ashab is here on the right. And you have Elsa Triolet and Louis Aragon, who came to visit the French group, meeting with the Palestinian communists. Most of the photos I show you here are by Yaakov Kristen, who's also a photographer that we kind of came across. And this photo, after they were so successful in Yugoslavia, they were invited to the first International Socialist Youth Congress in Prague, that's the summer of 47, And what you have here is something that we can call a multi-stable image, like the duck rabbit, right? You can see either or, where you have a banner that says Palestine, but you have the flags of Israel. So today it would be an either or kind of image, but it seems like at that moment, for them, it could have been a place where actually, you know, those two things occupy the same sphere and can somehow work together. And what's interesting is also, with regard to this multi-stable image, is that Palestine, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia are three places that don't exist anymore. And so that journey that I just described here also maps the way internationalism was existential for these people, for in order to imagine and also to plan a multi-nation state like Czechoslovakia or Yugoslavia as a political model or framework, you know, from which to start their project. Of course, we know what turned out, especially in Yugoslavia, after the collapse of that formation, but we also know what happened in Palestine since 1948. So these are the things I take from communism. And with this, I don't know what note I should call this note, but with this pensive note, I would like to call Malcolm Harris. Thank you.
Projection started. Thank you all. Wow, full room. Awesome. Thank you all so much for coming. Thanks to the legacy of real existing communism. Hope everyone voted today. Just kidding. No, seriously, you should vote. Or whatever. It's fine. No, but you should. My talk tonight, it's called Fixed Variable Capital, or How Marx Explains Why You Hate Yourself and Want to Die. And the sort of meta approach is like Marxism is a living body of thought still. There's words written, you know, that's separated from us by over a century of time that still, with like new eyes, looks kind of magical and can still give us unimaginable insights into our world as it exists. So with that, we're going to kind of dive in. So what is human capital? You've probably heard about it. It's the way we talk about it usually is the skills and abilities that you put to work when you go to work. It's an increasingly important part of our society, and what I'm going to be talking about is its relation to the production process, which has been, I think, under-theorized. So in post-liberal education, which I think is what we've sort of lived through, most of us in this room, is the idea that education isn't to expand your, you know, body of knowledge, become a citizen, it's to train you for work, productive work of some sort in the capitalist economy. And so it has a direct relationship to human capital. It's building national, usually, human capital. Economists also have suggested that it's this sort of iceberg of value, that our system doesn't have a way to account for the value of human capital, but that if we did, we would realize that we actually have it much better off than we think we do. We've actually been much more productive. We have more because we can do all these things. We just don't have a way to value it. What is production? So some of you might recognize it. We're going to go through it like pretty quick, so make sure we're all on the same page. This is the Marxist account of the production process from the point of view of a capitalist. So first you have the capitalist comes to the market with money. The first thing you do as a capitalist is you buy things. That's the C. You buy commodities. Now at this point, this is commodity capital because you're buying it to make other stuff. You're not buying it to enjoy yourself. Commodity capital is split up into MP, which you might have heard of as the means of production, and labor, which is a specific kind of the means of production that we're going to talk about how it's different a little bit. The P is the production process, like magically some stuff happens in the workplace when you combine labor and the means of production. The result in C prime, so you've got now another commodity that's bigger than the first commodity, different, whatever. You can sell it for M prime, which is more money. Now you can start the cycle over and over again and you're producing capital. You've got money that's producing money through labor and the means of production. We are going to be talking about that section right here, which is where labor appears to the capitalist as a commodity to buy. We might have an intuitive understanding of how that feels both to a capitalist and to a laborer, but it's sort of under-theorized, that position in this process. Where does it come from? Where does it go? Okay, so human capital in the production process, it's hard to account for where these like things you do when you go to work, skills that aren't just labor time, factor into the production process. And Engels and Marx, you don't have to like read the whole thing, I'll summarize it, just believe that it's there, have slightly different accounts of what this process looks like and how the value works. In Engels' account, which is more like an 18th century kind of upper class model, you have individuals and families that invest in your ability, right? You train to be a doctor, your family pays for you to train to be a doctor. That labor and that cost go into your ability to produce later. You're going to get a better job because you're a doctor. You get that money back over the course of your career as a doctor, right? You get paid a little bit more, and over time, you're going to get that value that you put in the first place for your education and that your family put in for your education. You're going to get that back as an increased pay rate for your work. Marx is a more industrial account where he's thinking about factory work. And you can't really train yourself to work at a factory, right? Your family can't really train you to work at a factory in that way. The factory has to shell out the money to train you how to work there. And so in his account, the worker in its human capital form is kind of another machine, at least as far as we're accounting for it. So if you're going to come work for me as a worker in my factory, I'm going to spend your first month teaching you how to use all the machines. I still got to pay you for that time, or maybe I don't, whatever. It's still a cost for me to train you. Over time, I'm amortizing that. I'm expecting I'm going to get that money back, much in the way that the doctor's getting their money back through labor. I'm going to figure I'm going to get that money back from my worker as a capitalist as they work for me. And eventually, I'm going to get all the money I invested into the worker. I'm going to get it back. So these are two separate accounts that can both coexist within the doctrines of Marxism. What that suggests, though, is the possibility of a scenario where you or your family pay to develop your human capital, right? You train like you're a doctor, and a factory, instead of dealing you out that money over time through wages, appropriates it themselves. They treat you like a machine, like in the Marx version. So instead of picking one or the other, there's what is suggested by the both existing is that you could have people paying to train themselves and capitalists reaping the rewards, which, you know, shouldn't sound too crazy to anyone in this room, because in a text called Human Capital, A Theoretical and Empirical Analysis with Special Reference to Education, George Becker, who's a Chicago school neoliberal, like real hardcore neoliberal, is thinking about this question of human capital. How do you value human capital? And one of his observations is, well, over time, as long as there's competition for workers, you know, you're in a really tough position as a capitalist, because you might pay someone to train, and then they could go work for somebody else, and then you're out some money. And so over time, capitalists have this incentive to transition human capital production costs onto workers and their families. Again, to bring back this sort of 18th century model of how human capital is produced. Which, again, might sound familiar to some people in this room, because that's a trend that animates like our lives, especially as young people, one of the like central things. Okay, so more Marxist jargon, but it actually matters, because as you'll see. So in the production process, you have these two binaries. There's fluid and fixed capital. So fluid capital is something like your electricity bill. It's something that you use up in its entirety during the production process. Now, this includes labor time, because it's time. It gets used up when you spend your time. You can't get that hour back that you spent working. Fixed capital is like machines. It sort of leaks its value over time. Fixed value is like machines. It leaks its value over time as compared to the fluid. So you don't use it up all at once. You use it up over a period that you're predicting. On the other hand, you've got this distinction between constant and variable capital. Constant capital is inanimate. Whether it's electricity or machines, it is what it is. It's not going to work for you. It's an inanimate object. Variable capital, on the other hand, is labor. It's people. You don't know what you're going to get when someone's working, but you expect it's going to be more than you're going to pay them, which is where the variable comes from. So when we, you know, examine these categories together, we can see, you know, fluid variable capital is labor power. It's used up entirely during the process, and it's animate. Fixed variable capital is human capital, right? This is this under-theorized part where it gets used up slowly throughout the production process, but you're going to get more out of it than you put in because you have this possibility of exploitation that we talked about in the last slide. Am I going, like, way too fast? Cool. Alienation. Now, what does it mean to be alienated from your project? This one, can people read that? Can anyone read that a little bit? Raise your hand if you can't read it. Awesome. So when you produce something as a worker, you're alienated from it in the way that it confronts you as something outside of yourself and not your profit, but your boss's profit. So what you're building, when workers work, what they're building is their boss's profit. And we understand this. That's why, like, you know, it's really different to make yourself some food or make food for your loved ones than it is to make food at a job, right? The experience of that is different. It's alienating. You can be alienated from your product. But what Marxism hasn't really theorized now is how you could be alienated from yourself. How could you be alienated from your own capacity to do work? Because, you know, work is useful. That's what we understand labor capacity to be, is useful abilities. How could you be alienated from your own useful abilities? But with human capital, we can understand how we build capacity that isn't to be used for us, that isn't to be, you know, used up by labor, as we might imagine this 19th century doctor or whatever, but is built to be exploited. We are developing capacities that exist only to be exploited. And then we're able to be alienated from our own ability to do stuff, which now we're going to explain with a video clip from a popular movie. So think about that alienation slide as we watch this from The Bourne Identity.
I can tell you the license plate numbers of all 6 cars outside. I can tell you that our waitress is left-handed and the guy sitting up at the counter weighs 215 pounds and knows how to handle himself. I know the best place to look for a gun is the cab of the gray truck outside. And at this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking. Now, why would I know that? How can I know that and not know who I am?
The answer is this self-alienation, this alienation for himself. Something that we can all experience as tools of labor, which I imagine everyone in the room is in one way or another. Marxism lives. Thank you.
So let me just start with a little survey. How many people in the last week have cooked a meal? Raise your hand. Okay. How many people in the last week have done laundry? Oh, pretty full response there. How many people in the last week have cleaned something in their house? Toilet, refrigerator, yeah? Okay. Wow. How many people have made a bed? Made a bed? Oh, wow. God, you guys are good. I don't make my bed. I feel really bad about that. Okay. So what does all of this labor have in common? Thank you. It is totally unpaid. So I completely agree that we have to talk about the exploitation that is inherent in paid labor and the way that we are alienated from ourselves. But what animates my interest and my work is this unpaid labor that is in the home. Let's just throw this out there. How many people have looked after a child in the last week? Okay, this is a younger crowd, but how many people have looked after an elderly parent? Oh, okay, we see a hand back there, a couple hands, all right. How many people have looked after somebody who's not feeling well? Brought somebody tea or brought somebody, yeah, okay. How many people have listened to the problems of a friend? Yeah, wow, okay. So what we see from these responses in this very small room is that a lot of us are doing all sorts of affective labor. We're doing work that is not considered work. Right? And what I'm really interested in as a scholar and as somebody who's been thinking about these questions for a long time, I'm obviously not a kid, but doesn't mean I still don't want communism, is partially because I think that communism or socialism or some form of collective understanding of the value of this unpaid labor in the home actually can transform our lives in a really positive way, that can make us actually feel much more secure and less precarious, even despite the very precarity of our current economic circumstances. So I really want to plug the book that I'm here to plug, Being Together Precedes Being. And you know, I love this title for a couple of reasons, but largely because I take it actually quite literally, right? Which is that all of us are inside of somebody before we become individuals. We're actually together as a duality, at least, if not a multiplicity, before we become an individual. So literally, being together precedes being. And there's a beautiful essay in the post-Soviet depression part of the book by Ian Svenonius, who I believe was supposed to be here, but didn't. He's in the West Coast now. And the title of this section of the essay, which is called Post-Soviet Depression, is called just simply Mother. And I'm just going to read a little section of this because I think it's really relevant and it really animates my own interest in socialism and communism as a concept. So it starts, on the one hand was the socialist East. Though popularly ridiculed as an evil slave state, the USSR's Politburo was acutely concerned with feminism right from its inception. Socialist philosophers Marx, Engels, Fourier, Kollontai, and Bebel all addressed sexual inequality in their tracks and had come to the conclusion that, quote, there can be no emancipation of humanity without the social independence and equality of the sexes, unquote, Bebel, 1879. Alexandra Kollontai described the family as a microscopic state where husband ruled wife and children that must be replaced with a type of, quote, free union fortified by the love and mutual respect of the two members of the worker state, equal in their rights and in their obligations. And then I'm going to skip down a paragraph or two. The Soviet Union's constitution therefore proclaimed women's equality with men in all spheres of life. And the 1918 Soviet Family Code established the right of free choice in marriage, division of housework, abortion rights, women's property rights, etc. Housework was to be a collective assignment, along with raising children. Lenin decried the housewife as a domestic slave and deplored housework as, quote, barbarously unproductive, petty, nerve-wracking, stultifying, and crushing drudgery, unquote. That's Lenin. He also derided proletarian husbands who shirked their chores, saying, quote, the husband must not content himself with assisting. He must rather do his share, unquote, in cleaning and caring for the children. This radicalism was carried on into the constitutions of the Eastern Bloc nations after the communist victory in the Second World War, replacing reactionary papal pro-housewife hegemony in places like Lithuania, Hungary, and Poland. This guy has got pros on his side, okay? So what I think is really interesting about this is that I'm fascinated as an ethnographer. I have spent the last 30 years looking at the transition from what we call really existing socialism to some form of kleptocapitalism as it exists in Eastern Europe today. And I look at Eastern Europe as a really interesting natural experiment to study the shift from what it was like to have intimate relations and familial relations between largely heterosexual couples, admittedly, under a socialist state to a capitalist state. So as a social scientist, I look at the theories of 19th century philosophers like Engels or Bebel, or early 20th century philosophers like Kollontai, and their ideas that love and human relationships will look profoundly different from capitalism as into communism or into socialism. Kollontai has this beautiful essay, Make Way for Winged Arrows, from 1923, where she actually does a Marxist analysis of love, where she shows that ancient societies, feudal societies, capitalist societies have very different ideas of what it means to love and what the ideal form of love is, and that it's not surprising, under using a Marxist analysis, that in the future, under socialism or communism, there will be a yet different ideal of love. So you have these socialist theorists in the 18th and 19th century, mostly in the 19th century, really early 19th century, starting with Flora Tristan in France, people like Engels and Bebel, as I mentioned, also Lily Brown and Clara Zetkin, and into Alexandra Kollontai, all of these people writing about the socialization of the family, writing about the socialization of domestic work, all of this labor that all of you are doing that is totally devalued in our society, will, under a more robust welfare state of some form, suddenly take on value. It will be recognized as being important. Because in addition to capitalists alienating ourselves from ourselves, as Malcolm just talked about, and by the way, I'm going to plug his book too, Kids These Days, really great read, is this idea that there's a joke, right? What I love jokes because jokes tell you everything that you need to know about the Eastern Bloc worldview, which is what is the worst thing about what is worse than being exploited by capital? Thank you. Not being exploited by capital, right? So if you're an East European after 1989 or you're a former Soviet citizen after 1991, being unemployed turned out to be a really awful thing, because all of the social safety nets that had once existed for you under really existing state socialism were eviscerated. So, and especially the social safety nets that supported women's care work in the home, primarily women's care work, when we're talking about care for the young, care for the elderly, and care for the infirm. So I think that one of the most important things about a book like Being Together Precedes Being is that it allows us to interrogate not only the history of really existing socialism, which is what my research is primarily about, but the future of some kind of socialist, communist, anarchist, utopian ideology that will value humans and human labor and human productivity in all of its forms over profit, over the ability to have money make money. And I think that we have to go back and really interrogate, and this is what I do in my work, really interrogate the history of really existing state socialism in Eastern Europe, because it has gotten a really bad name. So most Americans, how many people in this room have read in middle school either Animal Farm or 1984? All right, yeah, look at that. Look around the room and see how many hands are up, all right? So that is the primary way that people learn about communism or socialism in the United States, is through those two books. And particularly 1984, it's a sexless state where orgasms are not allowed, and the only love that's appreciated is the love for Big Brother. This is a stereotype of socialism, right? So when I actually show American students or American colleagues, there's an East German sex manual from 1969 called Mann und Frau Intim, which has like anatomically correct diagrams of female genitalia and explicit instructions on how to please a woman in bed. Most Americans are shocked that a communist state, a gray state with travel restrictions and shortages and purges and gulags and all of the things that we associate, which many of which, by the way, they're real, I'm not trying to pretend that they're not, they don't believe that these books could actually exist, right? That there was Polish sex education manuals, right? In a Catholic country like Poland. In Czechoslovakia in 1953, sexologists in Prague dedicated an entire three-day conference to the study of the female orgasm, right? So this is something that is completely unknown to most Americans. And so you have the stereotypes of this sort of sexless, these sexless states, and you also have this sort of fundamental devaluation of care work. And what I try to do in my own work is to animate the ways in which really existing socialism sort of dealt with all sorts of issues, both the socialization of domestic work, as well as an understanding of human sexuality, which is outside of Masters and Johnson's four-stage sexual response theory, that really thinks more broadly about human psychology, philosophy, sociology, and so on and so forth. So on that note, I could talk forever because this is something that is really interesting to me, but in the interest of time and in the interest of my fellow panelists, I just want to say that I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I'm going to give her this copy of the book tonight when I get home. I'm sending her off to college soon. I will be empty nesting, and I want to launch her with some radical literature. And so I asked Josh to dedicate the book to her so that I could send it to her, send her off to college with it. And I want to read you what he wrote. He said, "Dear Christiana," that's my daughter, "another word for communism is love. May you always be with love in your life." I think that's a beautiful sentiment, and I think that's one of the reasons why the kids want communism. Thank you very much.
So, hi, I'm Marissa, and I think I actually kind of realized as Kristen was talking, I think I actually might be either footnote or case study for Kristen. I mean, in my sort of real life, I'm an editor at the magazine Jewish Currents, which is a leftist Jewish magazine, and I'm a journalist and essayist. But I also sort of moonlight as one of the co-creators of a Twitter account called Red Yenta, which is a dating platform for the left that a friend and I started at the beginning of this year, like, spur of the moment, kind of as a joke, and then kind of caught on and turned into a really interesting and sort of surprising social experiment. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what we made and what we've sort of learned in this process, and then I'll just talk really briefly about what I think has been sort of interesting about this in ways that, you know, have not been interesting to reporters who have interviewed us, who I just, you know, want to like theorize what we've done, and everyone's like, okay, but actually it's a dating site. So basically, so Red Yenta came out of a conversation that I had with Mindy Iser, who is an organizer here in Philly. I actually live in New York, and Mindy may be joining us later, but has been doing election organizing all day, and she had posted something on Twitter about what is a sort of phenomenon she had observed of, at least within hetero dating, socialist men not caring as much about dating socialist women as socialist women seem to care about dating socialist men. And there was a really interesting response to that tweet where a lot of people, a lot of men in particular, were indignant, and in some cases, you know, in just sort of defensive ways, in other cases, in ways that actually seemed quite valid, which is to say, people were saying, look, like, I don't want to come off as a creep in political spaces. I don't want to be seen as, like, hitting on people at a organizing meeting. And so the way that, and so actually, like, for sort of self-conscious reasons, people were saying, you know, I've made, like, created a sort of boundary between, you know, political work and my love life, and, like, what am I supposed to do about that? And so we started talking about this, and I had kind of been thinking about sexual politics on the left in, you know, sort of more theoretical ways for a while, but also had really, you know, wanted this to exist in practice, just as a, like, just as a resource, right? And there was a Facebook group that existed a few years ago, and I don't think it exists anymore at all, but it was called OK Comrade, which is a great name, and I wish that was what our thing was called, but they already took it. But it was really awful. It was like, I don't know, it just kind of felt like the worst of the internet. It was like, kind of like weren't sure if people were people or if they were bots, and like, just seemed very troll heavy, and it wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't particularly interesting. So we thought, well, what if we just make this platform on Twitter? And we had about a week of, the first week it was a little touch and go. There were actually a bunch of people on Twitter who thought that we were literally FBI agents trying to create like a honey trap, which is an incredible understanding of what the FBI is up to. But we are not, sadly. And then after we muted those people, it actually, like much to our surprise, took off. And a lot of people joined. A lot of people made profiles. We started getting press. This was back in January. And so over the year, we probably have about 200 profiles up on the site now. And I'll just say, you know, sort of demographically, what we've seen is one, there it's sort of its own volition become very largely a queer and trans dating site, which has been cool to see. It also has had, I wouldn't say it's had like the, you know, I think our bar for like the geographical diversity we were expecting was pretty low. So I would say it's probably like 50% kind of US Northeast corridor, but like not, you know, 75 or 100%. And like the other 50% is has been all over the US, and increasingly actually like it's become global. And so especially every time we get press, we get, you know, like someone just wrote in from Mumbai, like somebody just wrote in from Palestine, you know, so we have like this really interesting kind of cross-section of people who have sent us bios. It's an extremely low-tech site. People just email us, they send us a bio, it has to be the length of a tweet, and we post it. Like, that's the entire process. I think the strength of the site is also like why it doesn't really work as a dating site, which is to say, you know, if you have, and I think there's some sort of, it all feels like almost like too on the nose as kind of like a tiny allegory for, you know, small scale left social experiments, right? Like it's the very geographic diversity of it means that if we have one person writing from Mumbai, we cannot fix them up with anybody unless they want to be in a relationship or, you know, get into a DM correspondence with somebody in North Carolina, right? So, you know, there really is a huge difference between what you can do practically speaking with a dating site that has 200 people on it versus like tens of thousands. It's just, I mean, it's like, it's actually just not even comparable. So I think that's, you know, that's sort of that's been the limits of it so far. And I don't think, I think it will probably stay sort of in the range that it's in because neither of us have the like time or resources to, I don't even know what it would look like to turn it into something radically different. I think what it has actually become is a way for people to experiment with describing themselves. This is what I actually think is interesting about it, that I think it's become a way for people to experiment with making themselves legible in as few words as possible and in, you know, sort of as charming a way as possible, as befits a dating platform, to people that they see as potential comrades and potential love interests. And I actually think that that is very cool. And I guess I'll sort of, you know, demolish a straw man here first, which is to say, I think that for people who have like rolled their eyes at us, which I get, that there's a sense that like that it's trivializing, or that or in the case of what it means to actually write a profile, I haven't actually seen anyone say this, but I think this is like what I detect in that there's almost something in it that's like kind of like leftist self-branding. And I think that, like, and I do actually want to take that seriously, because, I mean, we are in a moment where, like, of all of the things that can be commodified, like, left politics is now one of them, right? And that's weird, and that's something that we, like, probably all need to be on the lookout for. I would actually say, on the contrary, though, that what I think is cool about this exercise of people having to make themselves legible really quickly, is that there's something that's kind of radically de-individuating about it, that I think we're really used to seeing in queer contexts, on, let's say, dating sites, where, like, if you go to, I was saying this to Kristen before, you know, if you go to Grindr, right, like, you can see in 3 sentences, like, somebody's, like, self-understanding as a desiring subject and their understanding of who they are as someone who might be desired, right? To, like, put something that's, you know, like, very concrete and very abstract terms. I don't think I don't think that there's a sort of equivalent level of comfort with giving yourself the kind of like broad strokes self-objectification in a good way that I think can be really helpful for kind of translating your own experience of desire into a larger social context outside of queer dating. And one thing I think is cool about this platform is that it's sort of like queerness and straightness are all kind of mashed up. So it's like, that's not even the, you know, like that line doesn't even quite register in the same way. I also think it's true that even to the extent that that queer participants on the site might be more used to doing that kind of work, in making themselves legible in queer contexts, I don't think any of us are really used to doing this in political contexts. And I think that there is actually a lot of space to carve out right now for articulating Josh, what was the Jody Dean, the collective desire for collectivity? Like, the collective desire for collectivity, I think, is something that we're kind of just getting used to, you know, collectively being able to articulate without becoming, like, completely paralyzed by embarrassment. And I think that if Red Yenta is doing anything, from my perspective, what it's actually doing is, like, getting people more comfortable with that kind of articulation and doing it actually on a really personal level, because at some level, it is going to be personal, right? Like, it's collective, but it also, I mean, at the level of a dating site, like, at the level of a person's love life, like, it is also going to have to be like an individuated expression of that de-individuation. And so I think that is actually a thing that's been really cool to see. And I guess I'll just end by showing you some of the profiles. This is what they look like. They're really all over the place. So that's Red Yenta. We are also on Instagram. And I encourage you to make a bio if you're interested. And that's it. And I will stop there.
Thank you so much, Marisa. Now I'll move this and I'll invite the speakers to sit here. I think, to be honest, each of the presentations was very kind of concise. If you have any questions for each other, maybe.
So on the question of femininity, I think that what's really unique about the Eastern Bloc countries is that they didn't necessarily try to trouble gender roles. This is also a problem of the Eastern Bloc because they didn't really challenge patriarchy or masculinity and femininity in their traditional understandings. But what they did was try to strategically convince men using masculine tropes that they should participate more in housework. And I'll give you a very concrete example from Bulgaria where I do my field work. So women do primarily do the cooking in most cultures, but when it comes to grilling, because it's big slabs of meat on an open fire, for whatever reason, grilling generally tends to be a male job. If it involves meat and fire, it's men. If it involves cooking in the kitchen, it's women, right? Am I right? Right? Everybody's had this experience. So the Bulgarian Women's Committee understood intuitively that if you could code something as male, men would do it in the home. And so in Bulgaria, where I do my field work, when people drink rakia, which is a very strong kind of grape, distilled grape, like grappa, you eat it with salads. So it's kind of meze. So you eat it with chopped vegetables, what we would think of as almost like a Greek salad. So the Bulgarian Women's Committee decided that in order to get men to help out more in the kitchen, that they would convince all men that since meze, or these salads, are the things that you eat when you're drinking hard liquor, that only men can properly make meze, right? So they regendered salad making to make it a male thing. And it was very successful in getting men to chop vegetables. So it's a very different strategy than equality feminism in the United States. And I think that there's something that we can learn from that like rather than working against patriarchy, maybe sometimes if we use Gayatri Spivak's idea of strategic essentialisms, we can actually harness patriarchy to promote our own ends. And even if it's something as small as getting men to make the salads. To the second question about volunteer work, I think this actually comes very importantly to Malcolm's presentation, right? And how labor is valued in a capitalist economy. Anything that is Marx and Engels make the distinction between labor and labor power. And labor power is the commodity that's sold on the free market with a price determined by supply and demand. And anything that you do, whether it's housework, that's primarily what I was talking about, because of course I come from a perspective that is interested in women's rights. But anything that you do outside of the labor market, the formal commodification of labor power, this commodity that is sold, is in fact care work. And so when we're talking about volunteer work, when we're talking about political activism, many of you people in the room do political activism. When you're talking about listening to your friend's problems or visiting somebody in the hospital, all of that is valuable. I hesitate to use the word work because it's so loaded, but it's valuable time spent making the world a better place that falls outside of the commodification of labor value, of labor power. And capital is increasingly trying to commodify that. We live in a world where there are rent-a-friend websites, where you can sell your companionship to like strangers coming through town. And I have students here at Penn, you know, who say, well, rather than hanging out with my friends, I can sell a couple hours and like accompany somebody to the Philadelphia Art Museum and be paid. Damn. Right? So this is, it is potentially a commodity. I think that it's really important that we refuse the commodification of that labor. Volunteer work, political activism, care work is extremely valuable intrinsically to making our lives and our experiences as people more robust and happy and fulfilling. And the key to that is not the commodification, but it is the socialization and the valuing of that as a social good. And I don't know if Malcolm, you want to speak to that directly, because it's this question of labor power, right?
Yeah, well, so traditionally, I guess, and even contemporarily in Marxism, we differentiate between productive and reproductive work. And so one of the things that you, when you're doing reproductive work, one of the things that you're reproducing is labor power. So like, you know, caring for workers is reproductive work as opposed to, you know, productive work. And you can think of caring like caring for children who will grow up to become workers in terms of teachers' work is considered reproductive, for example. Or you can think of someone being sick or whatever. And I think what we need, rather than a like just a valorization of like reproduction, reproductive work is work too, which I think is a certain sort of strand of Marxist feminism right now, is we need to really understand the role of reproduction in the production process and what these, how these relate to each other. Because then we can see that this is not some like separate sphere. This is thoroughly integrated in the production of value itself. And that gives us a position to fight from within that structure, which is, I think, where we need to be doing it.